Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Jeffrey Swartz, professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus here, together with my compatriot, Brendan Berry, who is also a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus. And I have to start out by saying that the opinions that are put out in the discussions that we have are the opinions of Brendan and myself alone. They are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School or its faculty at large or its individuals. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, and yeah, they might be only our opinions, but they're the correct ones, so people can rest assured of that.
Oh,
right on.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there you go. By the way, that other voice is the voice of our mentor, patron, and all-around good guy gives us this time on his broadcast, Hezzy Harris. Good morning, Hezzy.
Good morning. What a pleasure to have you guys on.
Okay. So, I was thinking about, we start out every show with what do you really think. Last week I let Brendan go first because I wasn't quite know what I was going to say, and besides what he had to say was more important than what I was going to say. So I just said, you go ahead. But I couldn't find anything humorous to talk about, and then I did find something humorous to talk about. And so what I wanted to let everybody know, okay, is that I'm still waiting for the plan to come from Bill Gates as to how he is going to stop cows from farting. And as soon as he comes up with a plan, I really want to know what it is. I heard, however, that the chickens from Chick-fil-A had been picketing all of the Microsoft offices because, they want you to eat more beef. So I heard also that, the sheep farmers are also picketing. They want more beef. All the lambs and sheep are picketing. So I'm waiting for that to happen. And I don't know whether, I want to be part of that. I want to be part of the task force. I have some opinions. Okay, I have some ideas. Okay, and we'll go with that.
How to tackle bovine flatulence. That's the bovine flatulence task force.
I got to come up with some sort of what do you call it when you take the initials and you turn it into a word? I need to find up something for that. To tackle. No, HT doesn't work. I got to come up with something. Okay,
right.
The society in opposition to bovine flatulence. Okay. I gotta come up with that, and I'm gonna be on this one like white on rice. Okay, I'm gonna follow up on this because I really want to know what's going on. Okay, because I think it's really important. What I really want to talk about is something that I was reading about a couple of weeks ago, and I meant to bring it up, and I never had an opportunity to. And that was the fact that we now have another spouse at the SCOTUS, of a SCOTUS member, who apparently is making millions of dollars recruiting lawyers for prominent law firms. And she is the spouse of the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Law firms are hiring her. Find lawyers for them. And, of course, the lawyers that she is proposing are lawyers that obviously would have the same judicial bent. But more than that, these law firms are many of whom have had multiple and continue to have multiple cases in front of the United States Supreme Court. Now, can anybody smell a conflict of interest here? In the judicial world, the adage is the appearance of an impropriety is just as bad as the impropriety itself. So even if she, like Ginny Thomas, doesn't discuss her work and doesn't get ideas of, hey, there's clerks here to hire, let's find them jobs kind of thing, and he becomes involved in naming people or referring clerks to his wife to find them jobs or to find clerkships for lawyers that are out there, you know, I got a real problem here. There is an appearance of an impropriety. She gave up her career as a law firm partner to become a high-end legal recruiter. And it just happened to be right around the same time as her husband took over as the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And they wonder why people don't have any regard for the United States Supreme Court. That their rating as being respected is down to 25% of the American public. One would think these people are trying to put themselves out of a job by destroying the court. I don't know where they're going here. But this is a problem. When Jane Sullivan Roberts is making that kind of money doing what she's doing, when her husband is the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, I have issues. The appearance of this impropriety is the stench of it is Ginny Thomas. This has to end. I mean, when Ginsburg went to the United States Supreme Court, her husband never had another case that came before that court, ever. And they were law partners. There's something very wrong in there's something wrong in Denmark. And I just don't know what we do about it. But this has to stop.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is there any mechanism to oversee this and forbid it? Or is it up to a personal choice?
There is a statute that talks about family members of justices and that they should do, the justice should recuse him or herself when one of the litigants is either represented by or they are actually litigants of matters that appear in front of the Supreme Court. There is a statute that says that. And a violation of that statute would be an impeachable offense. I don't know why this isn't. I don't know why Clarence Thomas, having had the chutzpah to actually make a decision on a case that directly affected his wife, even though she wasn't a litigant, it directly affected her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. I don't know why this goes unsaid because, you know, first of all, at this point they can't even impeach him because it's a Republican Congress, but forgetting the fact that, you know, Democrats hopefully would take over the House again a year and a half from now, the truth of the matter is, forgetting all of that, you'd never get a conviction in the Senate because you need 67 votes. So I think the thought process of impeachment is gone, and that is the only punishment. They're a co-equal branch of government, and so therefore that's the way it works.
But you're exposing a deficiency in our government where it has to be a decision by both parties, and if one is superior than the other, then maybe it all goes out the window. Is there something wrong with our structure?
This is something we have not seen until recently.
Yes.
And admittedly, Supreme Court justices and the greater scheme of things to most of the people in this country make a lot of money. But the truth of the matter is that they don't make the kind of money anywhere near the kind of money that they could make in private practice.
Yeah.
okay? So as a result of which, a lot of time their wives, who are either lawyers or have other jobs, continue to work, and they have careers. And there's nothing wrong with that. Jill Biden teaches at a school.
Mm-hmm.
She isn't a member of Congress. She doesn't sell influence. She teaches middle, I don't know if it's middle school or elementary school kids.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she does. There's nothing wrong with having a career. The problem is when your career conflicts with the ethical obligations of your spouse, the two of you have to make a decision. Either you're going to get off of cases or you are going to find other employment.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two choices. The appearance of an impropriety is as bad as the impropriety itself. Both are just as bad, and in most states are basis for violations of which are a basis for removal, certainly censure. Something to send the message you can't do that anymore. So that I really think that if something stinks at the Supreme Court, people have a reason to question its viability and its credibility, and they're certainly not doing anything to help themselves. When all of the conservatives are going around saying, I'm not a political hack, I can only think of Shakespeare. Thou dost protestest too much.
Mm-hmm.
What about you, Brendan? What are you thinking about these days?
You know, before I get to my topic for the morning, just to kind of build on what you were talking about, you know, and Hezzy's comment too. I remember way back when the senior Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, was running against Bill Clinton for president, and George Bush was incumbent at the time. It was pretty much the mantra that George Bush would say over and over and over again in running against Bill Clinton was character matters.
Yeah.
And at the time, I have to confess, I was rooting for Bill Clinton. I voted for Bill Clinton. And I thought that this character matters thing was sort of a sorry mantra for somebody who had no good policy ideas and really, right. I mean, so, okay. So you're running. And I remember thinking, you know, what are you even talking about? You know, what, you know, in what sense? And it just seemed like a cop out. Looking back with the benefit of hindsight, he was right. Not that he should have beaten Bill Clinton, but character does matter. And we've never seen that in more stark relief than we have in the past, you know, five, 6 years. The reason that the presidency never went off the rails during our history, I guess the closest it came was Richard Nixon. But the reason it never came completely off the rails was that the people, we can say men, because so far it's been all men holding that office, who have held that office, could at least be trusted not to fatally wound our republic. Even Nixon himself, I just mentioned Nixon, maybe that's one that's the closest we came. Even Nixon knew when it was time to go. Nixon knew, by the way, when Nixon ran against John F. Kennedy, you know, there was ample evidence of shenanigans going on, mostly in Illinois, I think also in Ohio. But Richard Nixon conceded because he had the character to do that. He had the character. Now, he was not he wasn't the exemplar of character that one would hold up, right, for future presidents, but he at least had enough character to know that his own fortune and his own ego had to give way to the national interest in a smooth transition of power and a concession. Not until Donald Trump occupied the White House did we find out what happens when you have a monster in the Oval Office, somebody who is a malignant narcissist, in all likelihood a sociopath, who has absolutely no regard for the health of the Republic or the Constitution or the reputation of the presidency, any of the norms around the presidency, like you don't mess around with the Department of Justice, right? All of those were shattered by a man who had no character. And when Jeff, when you talk about especially Clarence Thomas and now we have Roberts, you wonder, you know, if these people have any character. Maybe George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush was onto something there. It really does matter. Maybe that is criterion number one for somebody who's running for president of the United States, for somebody who wants to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. You better be a person with some character. Know the difference between right and wrong. Put the institution above yourself. Be sensitive to appearances and optics, because that's important in government. That just seems not to be happening. I mean, I frankly was not aware of the Roberts spouse issue, but it is it is upsetting, and I don't know what's going to happen to the reputation of the court.
Well,
I think
the one thing we have to stress is you have to have character, not be one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. You're not supposed to be a character. You are supposed to have character.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. And, I mean, admittedly, we've had some people that have had, you know, Bill Clinton obviously had a character flaw. And that's a problem. Probably in my lifetime, the president who had the most character, who stood for the Constitution more than any other president, was Barack Obama. When's the last time you saw an 8-year administration that had nobody indicted, nobody investigated, nobody forced to resign for misconduct? That was character. That was standing up for the government and the job. We don't have people like that. Well, we're seeing in the Biden administration so far. But that used to be the norm, not the exception. But starting in the late 60s and through, I mean, Ronald Reagan. Now, you can't blame him. He probably was half out of it most of the time anyway. So people were doing what they wanted to do. But you had criminal conduct in the Reagan administration. You had criminal conduct in the Bush administration. You had criminal conduct in the Clinton administration. You had it in the second Bush administration. You certainly had it in the Trump administration, probably the most corrupt administration ever. So I don't know what you do about it. You know, there's a line from a movie called The American President. You know, I gotta watch the movie. And it says that being president is to a certain degree about character. I mean, and the response is that being president is all about character. It's not a sometime thing. And nothing else is more important than the character of the person who holds the office. And if they don't have the right character, then they are going to be corrupt, or the people around them will be corrupt. And it certainly has shown itself in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
You got to stand for something, not against something. You got to stand for something. So I agree with you on that one. I really do.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think there's... though. Sorry.
Go ahead.
What I find problematic about all that is, like, for example, we had this guy Santos, who lied about everything, and we didn't know anything about him. There's no mechanism to check the validity of what they say or their character. His character would have been exposed if there was a way to verify what he said. But there's no political mechanism for it. So where did we go wrong then?
In his case, there were people who knew. It's not he did opposition research on himself, and the people that worked for him came back to him and said, "You have to withdraw. If we found this, the press is going to find this, and you're lying about everything. It's not only going to be you're not only going to lose; you're going to be humiliated." And he doubled down and said, "I'm moving forward." So people resigned from his campaign, people who were brought to him by the Republican National Committee to win that seat. And you had a newspaper out on Long Island who started the ball rolling press-wise who found out all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But no one paid attention.
I guess I was ignorant of that, too.
Yeah, no, people caught him. Well, by the way, he's been caught again. Okay.
Yeah.
There was a guy that was interviewing for a job in his office who he hit on physically.
Hmm.
Okay? And when I say hit on, I mean, you know, sexually.
Oh, wow.
He sexually harassed a guy who wasn't even working for him yet. This guy is everything he claims he isn't. And nothing of what he claims he is. Man, bad guy. And yet Republicans need the vote because they know that they'll lose that seat if it comes up for a special election. We may need the vote. So there you go.
Yeah, add that to the equation. A political party where there is no bottom. There just is no bottom.
No bottom. There's literally no bottom.
Yeah.
You can't get to it. If you can't get to it with Donald Trump, you're not going to get to it with anybody.
Right. Right.
Okay, but that's okay. We got to talk about the latest story about Trump. Okay. First of all, let's bring it in the context of the it is balloon. Okay. I felt like I was in Fantasy Island with, you know, the plane. Okay. And instead it's going, it is balloon. Okay. everybody's panicking over a balloon. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about a balloon. And I guess we could call this a ballooning crisis. Okay. I can go on with those for a while, but I'm not going to.
Right.
We all know that a balloon, which doesn't look too much different than our weather balloons, drifted across the Pacific into Alaska, following the jet stream into Alaska. It hovered around Alaska for a while. Then it went down into Canada. Now, let's start out by saying that we picked this balloon up and started tracking it when it crossed into Alaska. We followed its whole path. And eventually it comes down into Montana. Then again, it comes down into Montana. And some people started snapping pictures of it. So the Department of Defense, I think it was through the spokesman for the United States Air Force, came out and said, yes, it is a balloon. We believe it's a Chinese balloon. We believe it's a spy balloon. Okay, and we're watching it. We're keeping track of it. Now, I want you to know this happened last Wednesday. The balloon then station keeps, it's got an engine on it that they use the jet stream, but when it wants the station keep, or move somewhere off of their course, there's actually an engine on it, a propeller or whatever, that can project it where they want it to go or station keep where they want it to. And it sort of hovered around Montana, Wyoming, I think it was South Dakota. It could have been North Dakota, but and eventually over Kansas. Now, I had asked Brendan, and I asked the general public listening now, what did all of those states have in common? One thing, intercontinental ballistic missiles. That's where our silos are. Everybody knows where our silos are. You can almost go visit our silos. There are farmers who farm in their fields with a silo cover, knowing right beneath them is a control, is an ICBM. We know where they are. Everybody knows where they are. What's the secret? It's not a secret. And it was watching things. Clearly it was at 60,000 feet because it didn't want to interfere with commercial air traffic. Most commercial air traffic ends at about 40,000 feet. Southwest has this habit of going above 40,000, and there's a reason for that, but it's a legitimate one. And everybody's, oh, the Chinese are going to invade, and there were people, survivalists and conspiracy theorists, who were sitting out in their front yard with their guns because the Chinese are coming. Okay, it was craziness, absolute craziness. Okay. And finally, you know, and Marilyn and I had a disagreement. She felt the president should come out and speak, or the Secretary of Defense, and she thought that was transparency and it calms people down. And of course, my attitude was, you don't send the Secretary of Defense or the president out to just say it's a balloon. We know what it is. We're watching it. Okay, you know, we're doing what we have to do. Okay. So that person that's his Secretary of Defense or the President now has to answer questions or be part of what will be a conspiracy claim that they're withholding information. It may really be our balloon. It's not the Chinese. Or they know that there's a nuclear weapon inside. That's why they don't want to destroy it. Okay? Or maybe they're going to drop a germ on us if we destroy it or something like that, okay? And so you don't do that. You just make a simple announcement, and the guy is saying, it says, this is all I know for right now. I know you want to know more, but I don't know anymore. You can ask your questions. My answer is going to be, I don't know, or I can't talk about it. And so that's what happened. And they followed it. And on last Wednesday, a week ago tomorrow, the decision was made, we're going to take the balloon down, but we're not going to take it down over any place where it becomes more difficult for us to gather together all of the debris. Because there's cameras and there's radio equipment, and maybe we want to find out whether they're using any American components to do all of this. What if they want to know whether there were American components used on this spy balloon, something we shouldn't be selling them anymore. So there were things that they wanted to know. They'd like to know what they were looking at. The odds are whatever they were looking at was being transmitted to a satellite, which they were using to control the balloon, transmitting it to the satellite, which then sent it down to China. They've seen all the images already. Well, but we'll find out what they were looking at. And then they waited till it was in American territorial waters, but off the coast. So the debris field was hopefully smaller than it would be on land, and a lot of the components of the balloon would survive. And into the ocean they went, and apparently they've recovered a great deal of it, and they're still working on it. But it's in our territorial waters, so the Chinese can't come in and start sniffing around themselves or create a confrontation. I don't understand. People like I do understand Mario Rubio, though, more than I think most people do, but I do understand Mario Rubio. Okay, Marco Rubio. The truth of the matter is, that, you know, he can't help himself. He has to create a controversy where there is none. And he says, I don't, the President of the United States should have gotten on television and we should have shot it down sooner. And he knows why, because he's part of the Intelligence Committee. He's been briefed. He's the chair. Is he the chair of the committee? No, I don't think so. But he's on the Intelligence Committee. He's been briefed. He knows what they did. He knows why they did it. He probably even knew before they shot it down when they were going to shoot it down. But he has to make a big deal out of this. The guy is so disingenuous that John Carl asked him on Saturday, or on Sunday. He said, well, Senator Rubio, you're saying there was a lack of transparency. Are you going to say the same thing about the Trump administration and the three balloons that went across the United States while Donald Trump was president and we just found out about it yesterday? He wouldn't answer that question. He moved on. I don't understand this hysteria. I really don't. Maybe you can explain it to me, Brendan. You got an idea why there was a hysteria?
Oh, my God. You know, I did want to point out, I don't know if you saw this. The same morning, this didn't age well. The same morning that it was shot down, there were on Fox News, they were opining that Joe Biden would not shoot down the balloon because he could not shoot down the balloon. A couple weeks ago, Jeff, you talked about a YouTube comic who's very funny, did a little skit. And you said, well, this is going to be the Republican answer to everything. Right. During this, this next 2 years,
Hunter Biden's laptop.
You got it. You got it. Okay. They actually said that the reason Joe Biden was not going to shoot down the Chinese spy balloon was Hunter Biden's laptop. If you can believe it, they managed to get it to Hunter Biden's laptop. That
of course it
is. Yeah, of course, right? Because, you know, that laptop must have all the secrets.
Greatest threat to American national security
right,
ever.
Right. Oh, my goodness. That was, you know, then, yeah, so that was rich. And in fact, there was a, Fox had a military analyst who was on live. And they had a live shot. They were showing a live shot of the balloon because, of course, Fox loves their, you know, visuals and bells and whistles. And so they've got a live shot of the balloon. They're talking to this military analyst who's moaning and groaning about how Biden isn't doing anything about this. And at that very moment, the anchor had to say, you know what, I don't know if you can see what I'm seeing, but the balloon appears to be falling out of the sky. So just they're in the process of complaining. This guy is complaining about how Biden won't do anything about this balloon. And at the same time, she's like, "Ah, it looks like it's falling out of the sky." I mean, these people are out of their minds, man.
The fun part was watching the videos of the people who were watching it, and they were cheering. And they saw the plane going towards the balloon and said, it's going to happen. Here it goes. Yay! Okay. I mean, it was like a spectator sport. Okay.
Right.
It was
right.
Like the greatest thing we had done since we dropped the atomic bomb in Hiroshima. Okay.
Oh, God.
That was
a man on the moon. Right.
Okay. Yeah. No, the man on the moon doesn't compare to shooting down a Chinese balloon. Okay, honest to goodness, because there's a lot of people who don't believe we ever landed on the moon. You understand that,
right?
Oh,
yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, it was all
staged. It was a movie set, yep.
Yeah, it was all a movie set. It was all staged. Okay, it never happened. But there's cynical. There we go. Yeah, we did it. We shot down a balloon with an F-22 fighter. Okay. Okay. Wow, we have proven we are – our fighters are powerful. They can shoot down a balloon at 60,000 feet. Okay. 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 No, it just knocked my socks off. It was just, I got to tell you, I was just thrilled with it. I really was. Okay. Did anybody doubt we were going to shoot it down? Seriously? Could Biden have done anything different and survived? Could he have done anything different if he didn't shoot it down? He had to shoot it down. There was no question.
Yeah.
And he gave you a hint on Friday that he was going to do that, you know.
Right, right.
They said, what are you going to do about it? He says, I'm taking care of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Wait, are you going to shoot it down? What are you going to do about it? He says, I'm taking care of it. Okay. That's my job. I'm taking care of it. Don't worry about it. I'm taking care of it.
That's the
guy who hasn't done anything at all but knows they're going to do something. He said, don't worry about it. I got it under control. Okay?
Yeah.
It's
amazing. They can turn something by any objective standard. Joe Biden did exactly the right thing by the book.
Yep.
Flawless.
And he did exactly what the military told him to do.
Exactly. I mean, and so they can even turn that into a scandal. He did exactly what they wanted him to do. He did it exactly the way the military said to do it. Textbook decision making, and that's a scandal to Republicans. There's nothing that this guy can do. That first of all
that's
isn't
true.
The fault of Hunter Biden's laptop, and that is not a scandal. You know,
they're going to find out. They're going to find out that the Chinese let Biden know very early on they were going to send balloons over the United States. That's on Hunter Biden's laptop.
Right.
I'm stealing this guy back there. I feel really bad about that. That's okay. He's got other stuff out there. Let's talk about something kind of serious here. Something that's happening in the state of Florida. There's a couple of things happening here in the state of Florida that are worth talking about. I'm starting to track Ron DeSantis and what he does. And how it fits into what we saw happen in a country in Central Europe prior to World War II. And I'm seeing uncanny comparisons. And I'm tracking those in addition to that, to what was announced prior to those things happening was the plan in this certain country in Central Europe. And there are two things that have happened over the last week or so. The first one was that the governor of the state of Florida sent a letter on behalf of the state of Florida to National Education Association. Let me find out exactly who he sent it to. To the College Board, rejecting a proposed advanced placement African American studies program. He cited six topics of study, including the movement for Black Lives, Black Feminism, and reparations. And Governor Sanders said that the course violates the so-called Stop Woke Act, which went into effect here in Florida about a year ago. Criticized the course's inclusion of work by a number of scholars that they felt were not worthy of being listened to. The anti-woke act, for lack of a better way to put it, prohibits the teaching of a lot of concepts that they purport relate to race and identity, none of which are espoused by this African American studies course the usual target, CRT or criminal race theory, the idea that members of one race, color, national origin, or sex are morally superior is not a claim made by any foundational critical race text. What it comes down to is that together with his refusal to allow African-American history, real events, not theory, but real events that took place, to be taught in the schools because it'll make the white children feel bad. That's really what he says. We're not supposed to make white children feel bad. Well, white children aren't going to feel bad. They didn't do anything. But the events took place, and their knowledge of them is important, so they're not repeated. They're not going to feel bad. They're going to go home and tell their parents what they learned, and their racist, white, privileged parents are going to say, that's not true. Your teacher is lying to you. We didn't lynch people in Florida. Black people were never slaves. They were free to go back to Africa anytime they wanted. They signed up to come over here. These things never happen. Don't you worry about it. That's one of the reasons why white people are better than black people. That's what their parents will tell them. So we're not supposed to allow African-American children to learn their history without it having been written by a white person. Is there anything you can think of that's more racist than that? Governor DeSantis, do you have ancestors who came from another country? Do you honor their culture? But that's okay because you're white. But black people aren't supposed to celebrate their culture or decry the fact that black people never wanted to be here in the first place. That we were the last country in the Western Hemisphere to still approve of slavery. The war between the states was not about slavery or the oppression of black people. These are things our children are not supposed to learn because it'll make them feel bad that they're white. I can promise you they're not going to feel bad because they're white. But you're going to make African-American children feel bad because they're somehow not allowed to learn about themselves. It's a form of intellectual genocide. It's absurd. And what bothers me more is that the college board backed down because Ron DeSantis told them to. You know what? They should teach the course as they designed it. And it's an AP course called Advanced Placement for people who don't know what AP means. College credit. And watch the African-American black children of this country demand to be taught this course because they're entitled to advanced placement on what they're interested in, not what Governor DeSantis says they should be interested in. This is one more step by Governor DeSantis in taking over the educational system in the state of Florida. You learn what Ron DeSantis wants you to learn. You learn it how Ron DeSantis wants you to learn it. You're not allowed to learn what Ron DeSantis finds personally offensive. This is just one of the things that totalitarian leaders do. They tell you what you can think. They tell you what you can know. They tell you what you can learn. And anybody that does not believe that Ron DeSantis is a fascist is just wrong. He tells you who you can do business with. He tells you who you must do business with. He tells you that you can't say no to people that he likes coming into your store. He tells the legislature what laws to pass, rejects laws that he doesn't like, and refuses to pass anything, to sign anything that he doesn't want and that he proposes. He wants to take over business and tell business people how they do business in Florida, i.e. Disney, which I think he's about to get handed a huge defeat on, because I think Eisner's going to shut down Disney World rather than be told how to run his business by a penny-ante governor who lives off of what he provides. He's telling us, in some ways, how we are to worship. He thinks he's the second coming, possibly the first. He is setting himself up in a godlike state in Tallahassee, Florida. And he wants to bring it to the United States as a whole. He wants to be president. He wants to be a fascist president of the United States. He fires people who disagree with him, even though they've been elected and have a property interest in their office, and replaces them with the people that those people have defeated who happen to be DeSantis supporters. I want people to tell me that this guy's not a fascist. And tell me why they think he's not a fascist. Because he got elected and he says he likes the Constitution? So did Hitler. He used the mechanisms of the Weimar Republic. And remember, it was a constitutional republic like ours to destroy it from the inside. And he wants to be president of the United States. That's what's important. He wants to control girls' bodies. We're going to talk about that. How much more does this guy have to do to convince you what an incredibly bad man he is? With his messianic complex. Now, to go with this, he's now decided all little girls, this used to be optional, by the way, all little girls, 10 years and older, they've got to keep track of their menstrual cycle and their periods, and they are to turn that in. He wants to follow little girls to find out whether they, especially when they get older, whether they've gotten pregnant. He hides it in the idea that all female athletes have to provide this because we don't want any little boys who think they're girls to be able to say that they're girls. That's not why he's doing it. He hides it behind that cause, which everybody, apparently, he believes everybody believes in. He is trying to control the bodies and the reproduction of human beings by controlling the females who reproduce them. That's what he's trying to do. It was like in Germany, they kept track of that so that they knew when a girl reached a certain age and she was ripe to have Aryan babies. Or to prevent others from having babies. This is really horrible stuff. This is so blatantly unconstitutional. they changed the forms that female athletes have to fill out from "this section is optional" to "you must fill this out." You want to know some of the stuff they asked? I'll tell you some of the stuff they asked. I got it here. This was in the form where it used to be optional, but now it's mandatory. I got to find it because I've got a copy of the form here someplace. Hold on a second here. Here it is. I got it. It says females only optional. It's now going to be mandatory. Okay? When was your first menstrual period? When was your most recent menstrual period? How much time do you usually have from the start of one period to the start of another? How many periods have you had in the last year? What was the longest time between periods in the last year? What's he trying to find out? You missed three periods. You must have been pregnant. Prove to me you didn't have an abortion.
Oh, wow.
Okay? That's one question. Who are we going to be coming in this state? Why is Florida becoming the headquarters for the fascist party? I don't know. But I certainly want to find out. Are they hiding down here because of DeSantis? Are they moving down here because they think this is going to be their country? Most of them haven't been south of Lake Okeechobee then. Democrats win races. DeSantis finds reasons to take them out of their offices and replace them with the right, far right-wing Republicans who ran against them. He's taken over the state. He's taken over Reedy Creek. He gets to appoint the Board of Governors for Reedy Creek. You think Eisner's going to put up with that? I don't think so. This guy is dangerous. He's just out and out dangerous. And I'm waiting for that first Zeke Heil salute that he gives, because it's coming. This is a dangerous guy. And he has to be stopped. Almost as bad as Trump needs to be stopped. Trump's a buffoon. DeSantis is calculating. I'm not even sure he's the brains of the outfit, but DeSantis is dangerous. He wants to take all of this to Washington, people. He's practicing in Florida for what he wants to do to the country. And something's got to be done. We've got to send him packing. If he becomes president, our life is going to be a living hell. And I worry for my children and my grandchildren. I worry for everybody's children and grandchildren. Where are you, Brendan?
Two, I suppose, closing points here. One is, I don't have kids. But if I did, have a daughter, and I learned that the state was going to require my daughter cord her menstrual cycles and report that information to the state, I'd be out of my mind. Where are the fathers of the state? The fathers of daughters.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I just want to know where they are. But we're back to this. You know, I say, wouldn't any father tell the state where to go if the state came knocking and said, we're going to collect your daughter's menstrual period information, we want to know. And the answer is, I guess, no. Because we're back to this idea. There's no bottom for these people. There's nothing that they won't do in service to this whatever this ideology is. But to allow your daughters to be treated like this, to allow their privacy to be invaded like that, to allow the state to monitor something that private and personal, it's absolutely disgusting to me. And any father who would allow that shouldn't be a father, is not a father. And I wanted to make one more point. While we're talking about decency, I want to make one more point, Jeff, about something we talked about earlier this morning.
Okay.
I saw video and a story earlier this week, a few days ago, about a college basketball game that happened at Colorado State University. And the team against which Colorado State was playing has a student athlete on the team who is in the United States playing, you know, pursuing his dream to play college basketball, but his home country is Ukraine. And with the game already decided, so there was nothing at stake. This was completely gratuitous. This young man went to the free throw line to shoot free throws. And people in the crowd at Colorado State started chanting, Russia, Russia, Russia. Russia, Russia, Russia. The young man was obviously shocked and devastated. He didn't make a scene, but the look on his face said it all. And I want to know what kind of person, kind of people, I'm asking this question a lot on this show lately, are capable of chanting Russia when a Ukrainian young man is pursuing his dream in America, causing him that kind of pain. What kind of cruelty and inhumanity are you capable of if you would do that to another human being, one who is suffering, whose homeland is suffering, who probably knows people who have been killed by Russia, who probably would have himself been killed. He's of the right age if he was still there. And what kind of human being takes the side of Vladimir Putin in this kind of a conflict? I was so disgusted by that. I mean, I just, Jeff and Hezzy, I can't find a bottom with these people.
You know, and it was actually unnecessary. First of all, it was a gratuitous attack on the player. The free throws that he was going to shoot did not in any way, shape, or form affect the game because Utah State won the game 88-79. They beat Colorado State. And what's interesting is that apparently there's an investigation, according to the Coloradan, which is a newspaper of the area around where the school is at. There's an investigation by the administration of Colorado State University by looking at video and talking to people that were there to identify the students who were doing this. It wasn't a big number, but it was enough that people heard everything they were saying and that they will be disciplined under the student conduct code, which could include them being thrown out of school. And a statement was put out by CSU apologizing to the player, whose name is Max Shulga. He plays for Utah State. And that immediately after the game, the players for Colorado State and the coach came over and supported him and apologized for what had happened. Okay? I agree with you. You know, no one's asking you to cheer for the Ukrainians if you are of Russian descent and you disagree with the status or the foreign policy of the United States. You have every right to object to the foreign policy. But this wasn't a rally. And the subject matter of that evening was not the war in Ukraine. It was a basketball game. Root for your team. Scream and yell when a player from the other team is shooting free throws. Wave your arms if you're sitting behind there. But you don't attack someone that way. You just don't. And I agree with you that we are just digging deeper and deeper and deeper to the bottom. And you know what they always said. If you dig all the way through the earth, straight across from the United States, where do you end up in? China. And I'll just leave it at that. And you figure out the symbolism of that point, okay? It would be easier for you to float there on a balloon, okay? Then dig your way over. But if you want to, go ahead, keep digging deeper. You might get there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because remember, the core of the earth has reversed its way. It's not spinning in the same direction anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that, Brendan?
Well, we could get into that.
Stop revolving in one direction and is revolving in the other direction.
That sounds dangerous. No wonder I feel dizzy all the time.
Yeah, there you go. And, you
right.
know, now I know why some people have no sense of direction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Point in a direction. Which direction is that?
It's actually,
well, where is
it's
the sun?
Scientifically, you're correct because the inner core. It goes in a different direction than the outside that we live on.
Yeah. But now it's reversed and it's gone in the other direction again. So I guess now we're going to start spinning in a different direction. Okay? The sun is actually going to rise in the west.
Ah, there you go. Good. It won't wake me up in the morning. Yep.
So buy a house with a sunrise view, and in a few years it'll be a sunset view. Okay. It's 11
all
o'clock,
right.
And we have to get ready for our meeting.
Yep.
We have a meeting, Hezzy. We have a faculty meeting today. We're going to discuss really important stuff. Okay.
Well, enjoy.
All right.
And every opinion counts, right? Right, Brendan? Mm. Every opinion
yes,
counts.
Of
right?
course. Of course.
Yes. Of course.
Oh,
okay.
God.
And
all right.
Have yourself a wonderful week and
you
take
will.
Care of yourself, please, okay?
Yep.
You too. Do all the best.
Bye-bye, Heather.
We'll talk to
guys.
You okay. soon.
What a pleasure.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Be well. Bye. My goodness. Just to get better than that, it almost feels like I should close down right now, but there's too much news to share with people. So let me quickly look, make sure that we got everything here in place. Okay, we're good here. So let's talk about this major, major situation halfway around the world. After the devastating earthquakes, Israel is going to send aid to Turkey and Syria. Search and rescue teams, along with medical assistance, are being readied following a request by Turkish authorities. And Israel has also agreed to send aid to Syria. Israel is preparing aid for Turkey following the massive earthquake that struck the country overnight on Sunday. Following a request to help from Ankara, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Monday, quote, at the request of the Turkish government, I've instructed all authorities to make immediate preparations to provide medical and search rescue assistance, he announced. And continuing, he said, the foreign and defense ministers have already been in contact with their counterparts, and we will, in the coming hours, agree on the dispatching of a delegation as soon as possible. So just before 1 p.m. a second 7.5 magnitude quake struck 4 kilometers southeast of Ekinoğlu, that's in Turkey, at a depth of 10 kilometers, which caused many more casualties and contributing toward the death toll to surpass. At the moment now, it's over 5,000 people. Well, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said that his special teams, which are attached to the Home Front Command, are being mobilized to help. The security forces are ready to offer any assistance that may be required, he said. The security system has gained a lot of experience over the years in dealing with disaster areas and the mission of saving lives. In conversation with his counterpart, Mevlut Cavusoglu, the Foreign Minister Eli Cohen offered a dispatch, a significant number of search and rescue personnel. Cavusoglu expressed his appreciation for Israel's willingness to stand by Turkey's side in its hour of need. Medical intervention is also being offered by private Israeli organizations. United Hatzalah of Israel, that's Israel's national volunteer EMS organization, is already preparing to send a relief mission. So during the early hours of the morning, I notified the foreign minister, the defense minister, the health minister, and the head of the National Security Council, the NSC, that we are standing at the ready to send a relief mission consisting of doctors, paramedics, EMTs, members of the psychotrauma and crisis response unit, and members of the search and rescue unit with medical supplies and humanitarian aid in order to provide assistance to the thousands of people in need in Turkey, said the United Hatzalah CEO Eli Pollack. Israel's version of the Red Cross, which is known as Magen David Adom, the Star of David blood, also announced that it had approached the Turkish Red Crescent and the International Federation of the Red Crescent in Europe, offering humanitarian and medical aid. Quote, in my name and in the name of the people of Israel, I express my deep sorrow for the terrible tragedy that befell Turkey and the region following the earthquake last night, President Yitzhak Herzog had stated. Quote, my condolences to the president and the people of Turkey for the enormous destruction and loss of life. The State of Israel, through its authorized bodies, is always ready to help in any possible way. Our hearts go out to the grieving families and the Turkish national or the Turkish nation at this difficult moment, he added. Prime Minister Netanyahu also said that Israel will provide aid to Syria. After a request was made by a diplomatic official, according to a report by Channel 13, Moscow sent the request to Israel. The earthquake, which struck at 3:17 in the morning at the Karam Maras province near the Syrian border, measured 7.8 on the Richter scale and was felt as far away as Romania. There were also several strong aftershocks. The Turkish death toll has already reached over 5,000, with thousands more injured. An unknown number of people are still buried under the rubble. In a televised speech, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that 2,400 people have been successfully pulled from the wreckage. The weather has also been noted as a danger as a cold front has moved in, bringing rain and snow. Syrian state television reported at least 386 dead on its side of the border due to the earthquake, with the White Helmets group stating that 147 were dead in opposition-held territory. So we'll have to get more. The numbers are way off because it's so hard to really understand what's going on here. But the point is, it is huge, absolutely huge. Okay, so let's let let's look at some other information, which I think you'll find interesting. Bear with me a moment here. This is fascinating because neo-Nazis in the United States planned a terror attack on Baltimore's power grid. Seems that on Monday, Maryland officials announced the arrest of a 34-year-old woman named Sarah Beth Clendaniel, who authorities say was planning to attack on the power grid in Baltimore. City's home to both a sizable Orthodox Jewish community and a large Black community, and Clendaniel and her accomplice Brandon Russell were allegedly inspired by neo-Nazi ideology. A criminal complaint unsealed on Monday accuses Clendaniel and Russell of planning to launch sniper attacks on electrical substations. As supporting evidence, the complaint included a photo of the armed Clendaniel wearing swastika-adorned tactical gear. According to the complaint, Russell expressed a desire to hit the grid during winter when most people are using maximal electricity. It would probably permanently, completely lay this city to waste if we could do that successfully, Clendaniel explained to a government informant to whom Russell introduced her. Among Clendaniel's Google-stored content was a manifesto-like document mentioning Hitler and terrorism. Now, U.S. Attorney Eric Barron held a statement calling for unity in the wake of the exposed plot. Quote, when we are enticed, hate cannot win, Barron commented at a press conference. He said, when we are united, hate cannot win. And Russell was linked to the Atomwaffen Division of Neo-Nazi Hate Group, which was recently named the National Socialist Order. Two of Russell's roommates were shot to death in 2017 by a third roommate who claimed he killed the men to stop an Atomwaffen attack. That means an atomic bomb attack, the Associated Press had reported. At the time, law enforcement found bomb-making material on the premises, which landed Russell in prison for 5 years. So that is one of the big stories. Unbelievable. Literally unbelievable. Okay. Now, let's look at some other things that you may find of interest. Bear with me a moment here. This is a little bit on the frightening side. The question is, can the bird flu, which was found in mink, I don't know how else to describe it, to mink, it's like what they make mink stoles from. Anyway, signals a threat, or the question is whether the bird flu, which was found in mink, is going to signal a threat of a human pandemic. So this is really fascinating. Seems that a bird flu outbreak on a Spanish mink farm has alarmed scientists. The virus may be spreading for the first time from mammal to mammal and could become a danger for humans. It started in October of 2022 when several dead mink were discovered on a farm in Galicia in the northwestern part of Spain. Veterinarians initially blamed the coronavirus, but tests revealed that the highly pathogenic avian flu virus H5N1 was the culprit instead. To stop the spread of the dangerous pathogen, more than 50,000 mink on the farm were killed. While farm workers themselves were not infected, the case remains a cause of concern for scientists. The spread of the virus from birds to other species is nothing new. The pathogen that causes bird flu or avian influenza has been found in raccoons, foxes, and seals,
though these remained isolated cases. While there have been some cases of H5N1 infecting humans, the World Health Organization has said there's no evidence of human-to-human transmission so far. When the disease has spread to humans and other mammals, it has been via direct contact with excrement from infected birds or their carcasses, according to Tim Harder, an avian influenza expert at the Friedrich Loeffler Institute Diagnostic Virology Department in Germany. But the mink outburst appears to be a rare case where mammals are transmitting the disease to each other rather than through direct contact with an infected bird. And this is something new, said Harder. Part of the problem is that mink are intensively farmed. They are kept in high numbers in confined spaces, which means infection spread rapidly in the highly susceptible mammals, said Harder. Harder added that researchers have identified several pathogen mutations in the mink, one of which allows the virus to better reproduce in mammals. Scientists are worried that the virus, which has led to the deaths of tens of millions of birds globally, could spread to more mink farms and become more transmissible. This is incredibly concerning, said Tom Peacock, a virologist at Imperial College of London, in an interview with the scientific journal Science. This is a clear mechanism for an H5 pandemic to start. Question is, could avian influenza trigger a human pathogenic, or rather a pandemic? Of the 868 cases known of H5N1 infection in humans worldwide between January of 2003 and November 2022, 457 of the 868 known were fatal, according to the World Health Organization. However, because there has been no sustained human-to-human transmission, the risk of human infection from avian flu is low, said the World Health Organization. Well, some highly pathogenic avian influenza viruses have an increased potential to cause new zoonotic diseases, which are transmissible from animal to humans and vice versa. While Tim Harder said there are, quote, numerous hurdles for more extensive adaption to humans, end quote, he added the mutations seen in the virus that infected a mink must be further studied and evaluated. Waterfowl have long played host to influenza viruses, but these early strains were low in pathogenicity, said Wolfgang Fiedler, an ornithologist at the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior, Germany. The viruses weren't too contagious or damaging. But when these viruses that were harmless to wild birds spread to factory poultry farms where thousands of animals were crammed tight, the disease spread rapidly and the virus could mutate, Fiedler explained. The result was the highly contagious virus strain H5N1 and H5N8, which likely originated on poultry farms in East Asia, according to the Scientific Task Force on Avian Influenza and Wild Birds established by the United Nations. Farm ducks likely become infected from wild birds. Ducks are kept closely with pigs, for example, which aided the mutation process, noted Fiedler. Such animal husbandry methods, quote, make a virus like this insanely happy. In fact, outbreaks of these highly pathogenic strains are typically associated with intense domestic poultry production and associated trade and marketing systems via contaminated poultry products, and inanimate objects, according to the United Nations Bird Flu Task Force. Now, the highly contagious H5N1 and H5N8 virus strains were in turn transmitted to wild birds via infected farm birds, explained virologist Tim Harder. The viruses could then be transmitted over great distances during bird migrations.
The ongoing avian flu outbreak is considered the largest observed in Europe to date, according to the European Food Safety Authority, an EU agency. Between October of 2021 and September of 2022, 50 million farm birds had to be culled in 37 countries. More than 3,800 highly pathogenic bird flu cases were counted in wild birds. Experts believe the number of unreported cases is probably much higher. So until recently, bird flu mainly occurred in fall and winter. Now the virus is also circulating in wild birds during the summer months, confirmed Harder, noting that the animals breed closely in large colonies in the farm in the warmer months, providing ideal conditions for the spread of the virus. Well, the avian influenza wave also reached South America for the first time in the fall. Peru, Venezuela, Ecuador, and Colombia were among the countries affected. In Honduras, more than 240 dead pelicans were found in 1 week alone. Harder said he is concerned that the virus could spread from South America to Antarctica and endanger penguin populations. Apart from Antarctica, only Australia has escaped the virus. And despite the acute outbreak among birds, Harder sees one ray of hope in that the broad spread of the virus could promote immunity in wild birds. Antibodies have already been found in live animals. So we'll have to see where all this goes, but very, very compelling news, to say the least. Now, let's look at what else is going on, particularly with Turkey and Syria. Time is running out for people that are trapped. And the death toll from the devastating earthquake has surpassed over 6,000, and rescue crews are battling to help thousands of people feared trapped under rubble. So the Syria death toll rises to at least 1,712. At least 1,712 people have died in Syria after a 7.8 magnitude earthquake hit southern Turkey. A Syria state news agency, SANA, S-A-N-A, said at least 812 people were killed and 1,449 people injured in the government-held provinces. At least 900 people were killed in Syria's opposition-held northwest and 2,300 injured, with the toll expected to rise dramatically, the White Helmets rescue team had said. Well, the White Helmets rescue team operating in opposition-held territory in southwest, or rather northwest Syria, warned on Tuesday that time is running out to find survivors, hundreds still trapped under the rubble, and every second could mean saving a life, the major issues. And I think I may have read this before, so I'm just, well, we'll see how it goes. Bear with me a moment here. Okay. And this is really quite interesting because one second here. Yes, I wanted to talk to you about this. It seems that wildfires are wreaking havoc in Chile. Hundreds of forest and bushfires have claimed numerous victims in Chile, or Chile, amid an intense heat wave. Tens of thousands of hectares or acres of land have already been destroyed, and large parts of the country are submerged in smog. One second. All right, 1 minute here. 1 second. All right, I think I may have misplaced this particular article about Chile, but you get the gist. Anyway, this is something else you'll find interesting. Salman Rushdie,
releases a new novel 6 months after the knife attack. Seems that 6 months after being stabbed, British author Salman Rushdie on Tuesday publishes his new novel called Victory City, an epic tale of a 14th century woman who defies a patriarchal world to rule a city. Written before the U.S. Knife attack that nearly took the Indian-born author's life, the novel purports to be a translation of a historical epic originally written in Sanskrit. The much-anticipated work of young orphan woman Pampa Kampana, who is endowed by a goddess with magical powers and founds the city in modern-day India of Bisnaga, which translates as Victory City. Rushdie, who's 75, will not promote his 15th novel due to his physical condition, although his agent, Andrew Wiley, told The Guardian that his recovery is progressing. He was attacked as he was about to speak at a conference in Chautauqua in upstate New York near Lake Erie on August 12th. The author had lived in hiding for years after Iran's first supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, ordered his killing for what he deemed the blasphemous nature of the satanic verses. The stabbing suspect, Hadi Matar, a 24-year-old from New Jersey with roots in Lebanon, was arrested immediately after the attack and subsequently pleaded not guilty to the charges. Rushdie, a naturalized American who has lived in New York for 20 years, lost his sight in one eye and the use of one hand, Wiley said, in October. The attack shocked the West, but was welcomed by extremists in Muslim countries such as Iran and Pakistan. Personally promoting the book, Rushdie has begun to communicate via social network Twitter, most often to share press reviews of his new novel. Several events are also planned to accompany its release, including a conference with writers Margaret Atwood and Neil Gaiman that will be broadcast online. An icon of free speech, since he was subjected to the fatwa that forced him into hiding, Rushdie is still an outspoken defender of the power of words. His new work follows a heroine on a mission to give women equal agency in a patriarchal world, according to the publisher Penguin Random House's summary. The book tells the tale of Pampa Campagna's creation of a city and of its downfall. Over the next 250 years, Pampa Campagna's life becomes deeply interwoven with Bisnaga's, from its literal sowing from a bag of magic seeds to its tragic ruination in the most of human ways, the hubris of those in power, it added. Well, the novel concludes with a statement, words are the only victors. U.S. author Colin McCann wrote in the New York Times that his friend Rush was saying, quote, something quite profound in Victory City. He's saying, you will never take the fundamental acts of storytelling away from people. In the face of danger, even in the face of death, he manages to say that storytelling is one currency we all have. The Atlantic magazine called it a triumph, not because it exists, but because it is utterly enchanting. When you think about it, Rushdie's novels are a miracle, it added. Born in Mumbai in 1947, so he's 3 years older than I am, Rushdie published his first novel, Grimace, in 1975 and gained worldwide fame 6 years later with Midnight's Children, which won him the Booker Prize in the United Kingdom. Victory City will be released in the United States today and the United Kingdom on Thursday. So, unbelievable. What a pleasure. I'll have to pick this up, actually. Goodness. Let's look at something really fascinating. It's already about halfway past the second hour. Beyonce has broken record for the most Grammy wins ever. So pop superstar Beyonce broke the record for the most career wins at music's Grammy Awards on Sunday, but lost again in the prestigious Album of the Year category, this time to British singer Harry Styles. Beyonce added 4 Grammys to her collection, bringing her lifetime total to 32 and surpassing the tally of late classical conductor Georg Solti. She was nominated for 9 awards this year. Despite her success throughout the years, the 41-year-old Break My Soul singer has never claimed the Best Album trophy with any of the 4 nominations in the category. Styles took home that honor on Sunday for Harry's House. I've been so inspired by every artist in this category, surprise, Styles said as he accepted the award. On nights like tonight, it's obviously so important for us to remember that there is no such thing as best in music. Styles had thrilled the audience with a performance of his hit song As It Was, sparkling in a silver fringe jumpsuit. The former One Direction singer triumphed over a formidable list of album contenders that included Beyonce, Puerto Rican rapper Bad Bunny, singer and flutist Lizzo, the British vocalist Adele, and disco era Swedish hitmaker ABBA. Well, Beyonce took the stage as she secured the all-time Grammy award, a record rather, with her award for Best Dance Electronic Album for Renaissance. Quote, I'm trying not to be too emotional. I am trying just to receive this night, Beyonce said. I want to thank God for protecting me. Thank you, God. She also thanked her family and the queer community for your love and for inventing the genre. Earlier, Beyonce was absent when she was named the winner of the Best R&B Song for Cuff It. Host Trevor Howard said the singer was stuck in traffic. He later handed her the trophy at her seat in the audience. Grammy voters spread the top awards among several artists. Lizzo's Upbeat About Damn Time won Record of the Year. She dedicated the award to Prince, saying the late artist had inspired her to make positive music. Lizzo also saluted Beyonce and recalled how she skipped out school in fifth grade to see The Hollow, which is a singer in concert, or maybe Halo. You clearly are the artist of our lives, Lizzo said. And blues singer Bonnie Raitt, Just Like That, About an Organ Donor, won Song of the Year, one of her 3 awards on Sunday. Both winners were chosen by roughly 11,000 members of the Recording Academy, which has faced complaints that it has failed to give proper recognition to Black artists. The group has taken steps in recent years to diversify its membership and overhaul voting procedures. Fans of Beyonce flooded several media on Sunday, making the word robbed, R-O-B-B-E-D, a trending topic on Twitter. Beyonce has yet again been robbed, Twitter user Corian Marie had written. Well, the ceremony aired live on the CBS television network and streaming service Paramount. In other categories, Bad Bunny took home the award for Best Musica Urbana Album for Un Verano Santi. I had to dedicate this award to Puerto Rico, the cradle of reggae town, Bad Bunny said, in a mix of English and Spanish. For Best Rap Album, Kendrick Lamar triumphed with Mr. Morale and the Big Steppers. I finally found a perfection with this album, Lamar said. The ceremony featured a tribute to 50 years of hip-hop, with performances by an all-star lineup of artists ranging from Public Enemy to Busta Rhymes, Queen Latifah, and Miss Elliott. Well, it seems that American jazz singer Samara Joy was named the best new artist. Oh my gosh, I've been watching you all on TV for so long, she said. All of you are so inspiring to me. U.S. First Lady Jill Biden presented a new honor for a song that tackles social issues. And that accolade went to Iranian singer and songwriter Shevin Hajipour for Baraye, which Biden called a, quote, powerful and poetic call for freedom and women's rights. That was huge. Now, one second. Okay. Well, let's go to South America again. It seems landslides have killed at least 15 people in southern Peru. Landslides in southern Peru have left at least 15 people dead, 20 injured, and 2 missing. Authorities said on Monday, warnings that the toll from the disaster could rise. So the number of people dead so far has risen to 15, said the Directorate of the National Civil Defense Institute in the Arequipa region, where mud and stone slides began on Sunday as a result of torrential rains. I've been to Arequipa. Officials in Arequipa have asked the government in the capital Lima to declare a state of emergency for the region. Unbelievable. 12,000 people in Arequipa have suffered damage to their homes or otherwise been affected by the natural disaster. Unbelievable. Okay. Now, let's look at some other things that you may find of interest. Bear with me a moment here. One second. All right. This you may find interesting. This is, see how long this is. This is about lithium. Yeah, it's almost 6 minutes long. This is, comes from Deutsche Welle, German world.
This is Silver Peak, Nevada, home to the only major operational lithium mine in the U.S. Owned and operated by Albemarle, a specialty chemical company and global lithium producer. Silver Peak is a so-called brine mine. Lithium is drawn and extracted from brine that is in the groundwater. The groundwater is pumped into a network of 22 ponds spanning 21 square miles. Hot Nevada sun evaporates the water and other liquids in the course of 18 to 24 months. Left over lithium, or light gold, as they call it.
Right now, we're really focused on doubling our production. So, you know, we want to get up to, you know, between upwards of 8,000 metric tons in annual production.
8,000 metric tons per year. Soon, sounds like a lot. It is not. Welcome to Thacker Pass. Just about 50 miles from Nevada's northern border with Oregon, Thacker Pass is supposed to be the future site of a massive lithium open pit mine and process facility spanning at least 8,000 acres, 7,300 hectares. Thacker Pass is believed to hold the largest lithium deposit in the United States, to be one of the largest in the world.
Not only do we need this project for national security purposes, but we need it for the environment. So we're committed to doing it right. We're committed to working with all the corporate parties.
Lithium Americas, a company that wants to mine Thacker Pass, has invested millions in the project. It has the backing of the Federal Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, and is in possession of all necessary state permits to begin mining for lithium here.
We're moving forward with preparing for construction, preparing for to onboard our workforce. It's going to take about 1,000 people to build this project. It's a big, big project. Pekapes, or Pihi Maho, in the language of the indigenous Paiute, is not only the traditional homeland, but it's also sacred ground for the indigenous nations of the Washisho, Paiute, and the Shoshone. That creates a bit of a problem for Lithium Americas and for the Bureau of Land Management. One of the tribes opposing the mine project is the Reno Sparks Indian Colony. Michonne Evans is head of the Tribes Cultural Research Program. She guides us through a tribal historic preservation exhibit.
That habitat is going to be destroyed for electric vehicles.
Evans' tribe and at least one other are part of a lawsuit against the BLM that aims at stopping the project at Becker Pass completely.
Let the people know that mining doesn't also just bring jobs, but it also brings annihilation to homelands and will annihilate indigenous people's way of life.
Lithium mine at Becker Pass will have a direct impact on the Fort McDermott Shoshone Paiute tribe that is just 35 miles away. The tribe just signed a so-called benefits agreement with Lithium Americas. The company will build several community buildings and pay for educational and job training measures. In exchange, they do not and will not resist the project, despite having significant reservations and problems with it.
Natives have always been considered stewards of Mother Earth. You know, this is borrowed. You know, we're borrowing it for the time that we're here. And so there's a spiritual connection to the land. We may not see it today or tomorrow. 5-10 years down the line, you know, what's the effects going to be? I don't want to push my elders and their beliefs and then the traditional part of it. That also don't want to ignore my younger generation that says, okay, we want to improve my lifestyle. We want to be able to take advantage of some of the benefits that are being offered.
There are also non-indigenous people who have concerns about lithium mining at Thacker Pass. Hugh Rancher at Martel is also a party in the lawsuit.
We have enormous concerns about the water table. There's pretty extensive vegetation here, vegetation that grows up to test time. So if the water drops, this will turn into barren desert.
Lithium America says their mine will draw even less water than what is currently allocated for farming and ranching at the pass. The company also claims to have refined their lithium mining extraction process using the latest available technology to guarantee minimal environmental impact. But for Max Wilbert, a member of Deep Green Resistance, an environmental group that some brand as radical, the idea of mining at Becker Pass is fundamentally wrong no matter what.
The company is telling us that this is going to solve the blowing up a mountain isn't green, and blowing up a sacred site isn't right. There's nothing more to it.
Pekka Pass, or Pihi Maha, is where different worldviews collide. A court decision about the pending lawsuit against the mining project is expected to be issued.
Okay, well, let's look at something else that's happened. It seems that the United Arab Emirates has pledged $100 million in quake relief to Syria and Turkey. The United Arab Emirates on Tuesday pledged $100 million to Syria and Turkey, one of the largest sums yet, following a massive earthquake that killed more than 5,400 people across both countries, but I think there are over 6,000 at the moment that have died. The oil-rich Gulf nation, which had already pledged some $13.6 million to Syria, is spearheading regional relief efforts, having dispatched planes to both countries with relief items and rescue teams following the 7.8 magnitude quake that struck early on Monday. On Tuesday, today, Emirati President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan ordered the provision of 100 million dollars for the relief of those affected, the official WAM news agency said. The sum would be equally split between Syria and Turkey, with each getting $50 million, according to the news agency. It was not immediately clear if the funds for Syria included the $13.6 million previously announced. A Major General Saleh al-Ameri, a commander of joint operations at the United Arab Emirates Defense Ministry, said on Tuesday that three military planes had been dispatched to Turkey carrying search and rescue teams who have since commenced operations. A total of seven flights are planned to the quake-hit countries, including two to the Syrian capital of Damascus, he told local media, and Syria's official Sana, S-A-N-A news agency, said on Tuesday that an Emirati plane carrying 10 tons of food supplies had arrived at the Damascus International Airport. The United Arab Emirates reopened its embassy in the Syrian capital in December of 2018, suggesting an effort to bring Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime back into the Arab fold after years of boycott. In March of last year, Assad made a visit to the United Arab Emirates, his first to an Arab country in more than a decade of brutal civil war. My goodness. One second. And I think you'll find it really telling. The mayor of Paris is backing a ban of Russia from the 2024 Olympics unless the war in Ukraine ends. So Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo says there should be no Russian delegation allowed at the Paris Olympics next year if Moscow continues its war against Ukraine. Hidalgo previously said that Russian competitors could take part under a neutral flag, but she backpedaled on Tuesday in an interview with French media France Info. Acknowledging that a final decision belongs to the International Olympic Committee, Hidalgo said she wishes Russian athletes will be banned as long as there is this war, the Russian aggression on Ukraine. It is not impossible to parade, or it's not possible to parade as if nothing had happened, to have a delegation that comes to Paris while the bombs continue to rain down on Ukraine. Hidalgo's comments came after Ukraine's sports minister last week renewed a threat to boycott the games if Russia and Belarus are allowed to compete, and said Kyiv would lobby others to join. No nation has so far declared it will boycott the 2024 Summer Games, but Ukraine won support from Poland, the Baltic nations, and Denmark, who pushed back against an IOC plan to allow delegations from Russia and allied Belarus to compete in Paris as, quote, neutral athletes, end quote, without flags or anthems. Hidalgo said she would find it totally indecent if Russian athletes competed in the French capital under those terms, but she left the door open for Russian dissidents who don't support President Vladimir Putin's actions to parade in Paris under a refugee banner. Russia has cautiously welcomed the IOC decision to give it a path to the Olympics, but demands it drop a condition that would leave out those athletes deemed to be actively supporting the war in Ukraine. The Russian Olympic Committee head Stanislav Pozniakov, who was a teammate of Ukraine's Hutsait at the 1992 Olympics, called that aspect discriminatory. The IOC, which previously recommended excluding Russia and Belarus from world sports on safety grounds, now argues it cannot discriminate against them purely based on citizenship. And asked by the Associated Press about the boycott threat and the IOC plan, Paris 2024 Organizing Committee head Tony Estanguet said that he would not comment about political decisions, quote-unquote.
Now, if the IOC proposal takes effect, Paris would be the fourth straight Olympics where Russian athletes have competed without the national flag or anthem. The Russian teams at the Winter Olympics in 2018 and 2022 and the Summer Olympics in 2021 were caught up in the fallout from the state-sponsored doping. The last time multiple countries boycotted an Olympics was in 1988 when North Korea and others refused to attend the Summer Games in South Korea. Amazing, isn't it? This is the sort of stuff that happens around the world. Unbelievable. Now, let's look at what's going on in Syria again. Syrian hospitals have become overwhelmed with injured after the quake. They can't take any more. Teams of medical personnel and rescue workers have been stretched to their limit after a devastating earthquake hit southern Turkey and eastern Syria in the early morning of February 6th. Opposition-controlled northern Syria has been particularly affected, and doctors report a shortage of medical facilities to treat the injured. Hospitals in the north have been completely overwhelmed in the wake of the earthquake. Doctors in Syria say they don't have the resources or equipment to address the severity of the sheer scale of the injuries endured by survivors. A number of hospitals were themselves damaged in the earthquake, overburdening those left functioning. And northern Syria's medical infrastructure has already been crippled by heavy airstrikes in recent years carried out by Syrian government forces and their Russian allies. So if the border stays closed, we'll find ourselves in the midst of a humanitarian crisis. The border crossing at Bab al-Hawa was completely closed yesterday, that's February 6th, in both directions. Since then, no one has crossed the border, including the wounded, sick, and ambulances. The hospitals in southern Turkey have received many injured people, and that's why the border was closed. Even severe cases weren't allowed through. If the border stays closed, we'll find ourselves in the midst of a humanitarian crisis, and so far, we have not received any aid other countries or from the United Nations. All the border crossings in Idlib and northern Aleppo are closed. So the search for wounded and killed in the debris is moving slowly. Since the Syrian civil defense teams don't have the resources to address this much destruction. My goodness. Well, it's absolutely frightening. All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to just wish you a good day. It's about 4 or 5 minutes before the end of the hour. And I guess that's about it. So we'll speak to you tomorrow. And don't know who we have scheduled for tomorrow, but I'll have to see. And we'll advise if we're going to have a broadcast tomorrow or not. So take care. Be well. And thanks again for all your input. And have a good day. Bye.